This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can watch our TV show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. Despite tensions between President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the United States has just signed a 10-year memorandum of understanding with Israel to gift it billions of dollars worth of military aid. The $38 billion of U.S. tax money promised to Israel over 10 years is a jump from a $30 billion gift over a decade that is now ending. As part of the aid package, Obama boasts on the White House website that, quote, the multifaceted cooperation between the United States and Israel has reached unprecedented levels. The aid package will deliver sophisticated and deadly military weaponry to Israel, despite its repeated international war crimes in Gaza over the course of several recent wars. At a time when global outrage over Palestinian human rights violations by Israel is peaking, Obama's handout to Israel is perplexing. My guest is Zaid Jilani. He is a journalist and writer for The Intercept, former reporter blogger for Think Progress, United Republic, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, and Alternet. Welcome to the program, Zaid.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, why do you think President Obama has promised this aid to Israel? What's going on behind the scenes? We've seen so many tensions between Netanyahu and Obama to the point where Netanyahu was visiting the U.S., going to have congressional meetings and not meeting Obama, which is a huge sort of diplomatic snub. And now Obama saying, you know, we are better friends than ever before, and I'm giving $8 billion more than the U.S. has given Israel in the past. Why do you think he's promising this?
Well, I think that the military aid relationship, you know, it's worth going over some history here. You know, it began, I think, in its current form following Camp David and the peace treaty between the Egyptians and Israelis under Jimmy Carter. And part of the sort of the terms of that was that the United States would start amping up, you know, significant military aid to both Israel and Egypt. And that's something that's basically stayed the course for decades now, but I think a big part of sort of what sort of determines the tenor of how that aid is distributed, the size of that aid, you know, what's it used for, is party politics. And both major political parties, whether it be the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, have generally seen it within their political interests to deliver big when it comes to Israel aid. The current package that was just negotiated over 10 years, it's a memorandum of understanding, meaning that Congress will still be voting on this, and it will still we'll still see it in annual appropriations. But it's sort of like, you know, us signaling our intention that we're going to deliver that aid. You know, this package I think is $38 billion over 10 years, which actually is a record high. You know, it was closer to like $3 billion or maybe 3.1, I think, annually, but prior to that. So it's a significant increase, maybe like up to almost 25% increase. And I think a lot of what that represents is just how cemented this military aid relationship has been between the United States and Israel, and particularly not just between the United States and Israel, but there's other players at work here, including the defense industry in the United States. This particular memorandum of understanding hopes to put together appropriations, which would include provisions that require certain parts of the aid package having to be spent in the United States, meaning that it's going to Israel's government. But Israel's government has to spend that money in the United States with respect to our contractors. So they have to buy weapons from, let's say, Lockheed, Boeing, Raytheon, General Dynamics, et cetera. So honestly, I think that's a huge part of it that isn't really looked at. Is a lot of people, I think, make the correct complaint that, you know, Israel's a rich country and we're giving them aid. But this aid isn't necessarily going to, let's say, you know, the Israeli childcare system. You know, Israel has one of the highest child poverty rates of any OECD country. I mean, a lot of it's going to come back to the United States, but it's going to be going to contractors, you know, very wealthy contractors, people who live in Northern Virginia who have McMansions and who create weapons, which honestly don't create that many jobs compared to a number of other ways you could spend that money. So I think, one, we have the domestic sort of political interests, which our interest groups demand this aid. You know, it's in sort of an easy vote for members of Congress. And two, we have that sort of larger historical picture, which is that the United States has sort of been locked into this relationship for several decades, And breaking that status quo is something that even with the tensions between President Obama and Netanyahu, we haven't seen happen.
I'm so glad you brought up the weapons manufacturers because they really do benefit here. I mean, in the White House Memorandum of Understanding on the website, it's just basically got this fact sheet up. The White House specifies by name some of these, very serious warplanes, warships, F-35s, the C-130s, some brand new types of military hardware, warheads, very, very serious type of hardware. In the context of the U.S., Israel's recent wars on Gaza over the last several years, how can we link the two? How clear is it that U.S. military aid to Israel directly impacts human rights of Palestinians living in places like Gaza?
Well, it's really interesting. I think technically, it's said by some maybe who defend this relationship that U.S. aid kind of ends, at the green line, meaning it isn't necessarily a matter of like we are directly financing things happening in settlements, for example. But that's not really true if you think about it, in the sense that our relationship with Israel in terms of military spending, I think it's something like 20 to 25% of their military budget is basically from U.S. taxpayer aid, meaning that when they have support operations to support, let's say, for example, settlers in the West Bank, that's the Israeli military defending those people, right? It's part of the mandate of their mission. So if the Israeli military is being subsidized by the United States, then the operations in the West Bank are de facto being subsidized as well, or operations within East Jerusalem, which is also Palestinian territory, which has been settled under Netanyahu and under previous Israeli governments as well. So I think it's really important for people to understand that. We often think of about this as like it's a foreign conflict. It's not really, it doesn't really have to do with America. It's some kind of ancient, But actually, the fact of the matter is that we're deeply enmeshed in this region, and particularly with respect to the ongoing issue with the Palestinians, because we do subsidize the Israeli military. Because the most common use of the Israeli military is to enforce that occupation. Israel has a draft. People, with the exception of some small groups in Israel that are exempted from that draft, most Israelis serve in the military, and that military, primarily serves to have tours through the West Bank and enforcing sort of and protecting settlements and settlers who are under, a decent level of threat, given the fact that a lot of people don't like them being in that territory. So I think, it's really, really important for people to understand that many people around the world, particularly many people who are, let's say, in Arab countries or in the Muslim world, who we want to manage our relationship with and our impression with, will view this as us directly supporting an occupation of the Palestinians, which we ourselves as Americans oppose. It's been the policy of every American president that the settlements are wrong and that Israel should withdraw from those territories and that Palestinians should have independence. But this policy of aiding Israel is in direct conflict with our own policy objectives, right? So I think that's a contradiction that I think eventually is going to have to be looked at if we do actually want to see a resolution here.
So, what about the how important is it for this particular aid package to be really scrutinized in terms of just, whether it's actually helping Israel's security? Even if you use that frame, one of the big things in this 10-year memorandum of understanding is boosting its missile defense capabilities. You see this over and over again. This Israel has long touted its Iron Dome system. There's another system now called the David and Arrow Sling. And it's arguable whether these are really protecting Israel, presumably from some of the sporadic rocket fires coming from Hamas-controlled areas of Gaza.
Well, it's interesting. I think that I don't think there are really sort of comprehensive audits of how the financing is used and what's been effective and what hasn't been effective. I mean, I think you brought up the Iron Dome system, when that's actually a system that's under, I think, constant criticism and argumentation in terms of how effective it actually is in sort of intercepting fire, particularly during conflicts with Gaza. But with respect to, what it actually does to protect Israel's security, I mean, it does. It is true that Israel's, the politicians use this phrase often of sort of a qualitative edge in terms of its military capabilities. And I do think that USAID does create that for Israel. But I think that the larger question, which is more of a question of a political solution of their conflict and their main threat, which is basically insecurity created by the fact they have not resolved the Palestinian issue. I think that question is not really resolved by militarily aiding Israel, right? Like giving Israel weapons is not going to create a solution for Palestinian independence or some kind of resolution of the fact that Israelis are in danger of terrorism as long as they're maintaining a situation where Palestinians feel attracted to use it because they don't have independence and they don't have civil rights. So I think that's a really important question about the Israeli security that isn't necessarily asked by people in Congress who view it as an easy vote to continue to send weapons because, defense contractors like it and people involved in pro-Israel politics like it. Because, at the end of the day, a political solution is what's needed here. Giving, Israel more and more weapons is not going to, it's not going to be the lever that pushes them to do that.
Right. The U.S. gives Israel more foreign military aid than any other country. The country that comes second is Egypt, which is less than half of what which gets less than half of what Israel gets. In addition, President Obama also says, or his memorandum of understanding talks about the massive amounts of additional things that the U.S. military gives to Israel, including basically gifts of military aid, excess military aid, and excess military weaponry that the U.S. military, surplus military weaponry that the U.S. doesn't need. President Obama boasted that this aid package is just the most recent reflection of my steadfast commitment to the security of the state of Israel. It will make a significant contribution to Israel's security in what remains a dangerous neighborhood. The continued supply of the world's most advanced weapons technology will ensure that Israel has the ability to defend itself from all manner of threats. Now, Zaid, doesn't Obama, in making this overt commitment to Israel, using the terms dangerous neighborhood, effectively slap down any regional players and kind of undermine this idea that the U.S. is in any way an impartial broker of peace? I mean, it's basically saying we choose Israel over all of Israel's neighbors, including Palestinians.
Well, I think, there was a story written when Obama first came into office. Apparently, he had a meeting with some, domestic interest groups who tend to lobby for status quo, meaning they lobby for military aid, for diplomatic protection of Israel, so on and so forth. And the story was written to say that, many of these leaders said that there should be no daylight between the United States and Israel. And Obama said, well, we had that under President Bush, and we had no daylight, and because of that, we had no progress. And so I think Barack Obama has, at various points in his career, sort of recognized the implicit contradiction here that basically giving aid to Israel without any strings attached or despite whatever they do is not going to produce a different result, right? That's typically U.S. policy, and it's leading to the typical result. However, I think President Obama ultimately made a decision that he was not going to extend the level of political capital needed, meaning he wasn't going to face off with defense contractors or with organizations that, lobby for pro-Israel interests. And I think ultimately he did not take the steps needed to bring a resolution here. I mean, I think that in some respects he took less bold steps than some of our previous presidents. For example, the first President Bush, President George H.W. Bush, used a hold or a freeze on loan guarantees to Israel to get them to the table, to start bringing them to peace conferences and to start recognizing some level of Palestinian sovereignty and authority. The president prior to that, Ronald Reagan, I believe at one point froze cluster bomb shipments to Israel because they were using them in the war with Lebanon. President George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush's son, at one point did allow the United Nations Security Council to issue a condemnation of Israel with respect to housing demolitions. So I think that, Barack Obama is particularly by the far right in the United States, it was often demonized as being a very harshly anti-Israel president. And it's certainly true that he clashed in public with Netanyahu over a number of his policies, that he pursued a nuclear deal with Iran that Israel was certainly not a fan of. But with respect to the core issues, which is military aid to Israel, diplomatic protection of Israel, and just the basic relationship, Barack Obama did not change very much. And I think, that can be hard for some people who are both supporters of the president and detractors of the president to admit. But I think that ultimately, 8 years later, I think Obama did not live up to his own implicit critique of the relationship with the steps that he took.
Finally, one of the things that is also a very important part of U.S.-Israeli friendship is information control. There's been massive major battles playing out all over the U.S. for many years now about getting accurate, factual, unbiased information about Israel, Israeli occupation, Israeli wars, etc. And one of the places where that's now playing out because of its increasing use is social media, and in particular, Facebook. Israel seems to think that the free use of social media is helping to incite or facilitate Palestinian attacks against Israelis, and has partnered dangerously with Facebook in a story that The Intercept and your colleague Glenn Greenwald reported on. Tell us exactly how Israel thinks that it can harness Facebook in essentially keeping information or controlling information, which seems to be kind of a dangerous precedent.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this is a really interesting question in that I think a number of global governments, and not just governments, but civil society groups have urged Facebook to act against certain types of incitement of hate or against threats or some kind of explicit or harassment speech. So I think most people think that Facebook maybe should have some sort of regulation of those or concerns. The problem is that when those things are conflated with legitimate political speech, within the state of Israel, we often see that line blurred with respect to how they tackle social media. For example, in Israel, denying the Holocaust is against the law. In the United States, such a thing is not the case, right? But despite the fact that Facebook is an American company, it does obey the law and edicts as it goes across the world. And because Facebook is active, in Israel, it has actually taken down posts that have denied the Holocaust, which of course would be a free speech right in the United States, but is against the law in Israel. In addition to that, Israeli police have detained Palestinians who have been, made remarks that they would suggest would are indicative of some sort of radicalism, or perhaps these people would engage in criminal acts because of the remarks they made on Facebook. Typically within the United States, the way we think about these things is that, for example, our police will not arrest someone unless they make like a direct threat. Like if they say that, oh, I'm going to, harm the president, and it's seen as a direct and credible threat, then the police may arrest and interrogate that person. I think a lot of what's happening in Israel is being viewed as a form of political repression, however, where they are cracking down on people who they perceive to be harshly critical of Israel, or maybe who could be inciting some sorts of act of what they perceive to be anti-Israel activities. And I think the way that line is drawn is not only something that would be important with respect to Israel, but I think all over the world we're seeing this with the proliferation of social media.
I just can imagine a future where essentially Mark Zuckerberg meets with all manner of governments seeking to repress information in their own countries and simply casting it as protecting against hate speech. Certainly a dangerous precedent. A lot of people have now begun referring to Mark Zuckerberg as editor-in-chief of the world, and that's very, very dangerous. Zaid, is theintercept.com the best place to read your writings?
Yes, and not only mine, but I have many talented colleagues who also do great writing, so I definitely encourage everyone to go on there.
That's theintercept.com. Zaid Jilani, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Zaid Jilani is a journalist and writer for The Intercept, former reporter, blogger for Think Progress, United Republic, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, and Alternet. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com and on Twitter at twitter.com/ruwithsonali.